Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have one of the episodes in the mini series, which is your child isn't acting out, they're actually burning out. And of course, what better person to have Tanya Waring. How are you, Tanya?
I'm really well, thanks, Jane.
So Tanya is an ex-lawyer. She's also studying a PhD in co-regulation in the classroom. Tanya, do you want to give us a little bit of an intro about who you are?
I was a lawyer for a long time. I ended up having to give that up in order to advocate for particularly my youngest of three boys, who is ADHD and autistic. And so to better understand what was going on for him, I went back to uni and did psychology. I did honours and now I'm doing my PhD in inclusive education and my topic is on co-regulation in the classroom. So it certainly lit a fire within because I think we need to keep advocating for change in schools and I think teachers want change in schools as well.
Perfect. So I've got Millie Carr on for some of the episodes. She is more in the area around the internalising children. And so I've got Tanya in more of those externalizing behaviors that we see as troublesome. And I've spoken about many times, and I heard it just the other day, pick up actually, where someone said, oh, have you heard about this child, Simon, whatever his name is? He's doing this and this. I think he has that ADHD autism thing. And I'm like, oh my God, people are still saying it. He's not necessarily a naughty child. You don't even know if he's diagnosed with anything. But then they're kind of saying it like, oh, that's like, I'm not meaning being mean about him. He's probably got something wrong with him. And as if to negate the fact that they're talking about him like that. And I just had to move away. I was like, oh my God, here we are again.
Yeah. And it's sort of, that can lead into a diagnosis is kind of an excuse for any behavior that's unwanted or not expected. And I think we need to look at behavior differently. Behavior is communication and if a child, regardless of diagnosis, is behaving in a way that you wouldn't expect or that isn't consistent with their peers, then I think it's on the adults to be curious about what's going on with that child that they are behaving in that way. Because we have to come at this from the perspective of the child is doing their best in regardless of what that behavior is. It is their best in that moment. And if it is screaming or throwing things or even getting up and walking around the classroom, if that's not what you want, then be curious about why that child's doing that. And then there's lots of other questions, whether to what extent we can adjust their expectations about that child or any other child. Is it a reasonable thing for a child to get up and walk around the classroom? Why not? Do you know what I mean? Like you can look at the environment and think, well, how important is it that a four-year-old or a five-year-old child sits completely still and listens with their whole body? Maybe it's not that important. Like maybe it's the case that some kids are not able to do that at that age and they need to get up and walk around the classroom and still be listening to you, but listening in a way where they're regulating their body's needs and be curious about it. What's going on? And then problem solve. What can we do in this situation to see if we can get everyone's needs met?
I agree. So if we look at the responses, and Millie Carr said in one of her early episodes that she thinks the way that kids represent the majority are either fighting, like they're fighting the system, they come across as disruptive, they are actively not wanting to comply, can't comply, and they, I suppose, noticeable. And then you've got the other children who are more fawning, like they're taking it, they're saying yes, but then at the end of the day, as the mum, I have two of these, I asked them, can you put your lunchbox on the bench? And it's one of them just threw it at the wall yesterday. And I was like, wow, that was a very simple request. He has no more yeses today. So if we look at the advocacy in this episode around more of the children who are not able to comply or don't want to comply, and the system is really just not tailored to them at all, that is a different area of advocacy, I think, than the other area, which is those internalizing children who are holding it in and exploding at home. Yep. So what are some of the key things that parents need to understand in more of that fighting response about their rights when advocating for a child at school?
It sort of depends on their age because it changes as they grow. A four-year-old who's throwing things around a classroom is a different thing to a 14-year-old, and your conversations are going to be a bit different. I think in both cases, you're still pleading with the system to acknowledge that the child is doing their best and to be curious about what's going on for the child, that that's what's happening. As a parent, building that relationship with the school is fundamental. And sometimes it's really hard, like especially if you're coming up against a principal who isn't interested in providing the support dollars in classrooms to support kids who are neurodiverse or who keep pulling money out of those established programs. And as a parent, all you can do is keep being in there, and without trying to burn your bridges and without trying to put everyone offside, to keep the conversations alive, because it's only by that exchange of information can you do the best thing for the kid. The teacher on their journey in the classroom, part of their journey is to get to know each of the kids in the classroom and get to know them well enough that they can respond if the child's in crisis or the child is under distress for some reason. Some kids are going to need more of the teacher's time than others, and that is okay because some kids find it cruise along. Now, two of your kids fall into a category who might look like they're cruising along just fine but need more support despite it not being obvious. But for kids, for like my son, who externalize distress, then it is obvious that they're going to need a bit more support. In any classroom of 30 kids, there might be five or six kids who are obviously going to need a bit more support early on. The teacher will be able to tell that within the first week. And what I would say is use that first week to identify those kids and then put some more time into those kids. By putting a bit more time into those kids, building a relationship with them, which is key to absolutely everything, building a positive, trusting relationship with each of those kids, you are demonstrating to every other kid in the classroom who's watching, and they are all watching and listening, that you as the teacher are someone they can trust because they can see how you are responding to a child who is not doing well. So if they see you with a vulnerable child, being curious, helping them problem solve, co-regulating with them, then they will naturally be inclined to trust you because they can see how kind and empathic you're being with a kid in distress. So if you can engage teachers to give them that message, then maybe we'll see a bit more of that going on. Some teachers would probably do that naturally, but they're probably not the teachers that you're going to be having to advocate with to stop punishing your child because they're doing things that they don't like. What we do know from the research, so much research, is that punishment is not going to change that behavior. If you want behavior change, then you need to invest in the relationship. If you want to ostracize, humiliate, shame a child, then keep putting their name on the bottom of that behavior ladder. Keep taking dojo points off them. Keep suspending them. Keep punishing them and excluding them from the classroom. That is only going to lead to worse and worse behavior because you're also destroying the relationship that you have with that child. You need to invest in that relationship, make it a positive relationship. And that's hard sometimes because sometimes it's confronting and triggering to have a child behave in a way that's, you know, might be loud, might be offensive language, might be throwing things around the classroom, none of which is acceptable. I'm not excusing that behavior. But if you want that behavior to change, then it's on you as the adult to change your relationship with that kid. And that's not something you can do overnight. And there's no magic bullet for that. There's no medication that's going to change that. I think there's an over-reliance. Medication's an important part of a picture with a student with ADHD. Only about 80% of students with ADHD derive a significant benefit from a stimulant type medication. And even when they do, it doesn't mean they don't have ADHD anymore. It just means that they have one tool that they are using, and they still need you to understand that about them, and they still need you to scaffold them in the classroom. Yeah, it's not, there's no magic cure. It doesn't turn them into someone else. It's just one thing.
Yeah, it is really tricky. We had a new teacher at our school this year, and I have one child that's quite disruptive, and he can be very troublesome if he is not acknowledged or doesn't feel like seen. He's very good in some kind of leadership position. Like, just let him rub off the board, like the whiteboard. If that's his job, he's actually quite engaged, and he can be excellent when he wants to be. If he doesn't feel seen, he doesn't feel connected, he will go around and he's very clever, and he will actually upset everybody around him. He's very clever. He will go around to all of the explosive kids and he will set them off. And he's always done this. And so I said to the teacher up front, you really need to invest in some time with him, because he will make your life quite difficult in the classroom across a number of different areas if he isn't actually on side with you. It might only take you 5 minutes. Like, it's actually, you don't need to do it all the time. Just give him 2 or 3 minutes in the first week. Give him a couple of leadership roles. Anyway, she didn't really listen to me. And of course, that's what happened. But partway through the term, she came back and said, oh, what were you saying again? Because we're seeing a little bit of this and that. So I suppose around those feelings of being dismissed, or in maybe that the teacher is correct and you're not right, or you don't want to tell the teacher or come across high maintenance, how can we start building up some of those advocacy skills?
Well, things I've done in the past, I've provided articles, I've provided research articles, I've provided blog post articles, I've emailed links to podcasts like this one, At the Attitude podcast, ADHD Australia information. I've tried to provide information from expert sources that will inform their decision making going forward.
Oh, it is
hard, because there is a real reluctance to change and for the teacher to take it on board as, I might need to do something different. That is a very difficult headspace to engage.
It is tricky, and sometimes I really had to look at my language, because it sounds like a threat when I say it in my head, but I don't mean it that way. Like, what I want to say is, this particular child could possibly be a real issue for you. So we need to get ahead of this. And I could, as a mother, be a real problem for you. However, if we can get the trust and the relationship, and it won't take long, you won't see or hear from me all term, and my son will be no problems. But the language can be real tricky for me, because I'm such a straight shooter. But then I think, I don't want to come across threatening.
Yeah, it's so difficult, because in the end, you're asking them to do something differently. You're asking them to even share expertise in the classroom. And I think that's hard for teachers too, because you're not a teacher, I'm not a teacher. So don't tell me how to be a teacher. I think that's absolutely part of the problem. But I guess what parents are expert in is, A, their own child. And also, if you've got a child with a disability of any description, most parents have really boned up on that disability, and they have a lot of information to offer around that, particularly as it pertains to their child. So in order for a teacher to get across each of the kids in their classroom, parents are an obvious source of information and support. And there's so much research that talks about the importance of that partnership between school, teacher and family to support kids going through school, particularly in primary school. But I would also say in high school, and that's where I'm focusing my research on, is that there's just not enough done in high schools to keep that, or to even enable that relationship to be established and developed. Very hard to get in front of a teacher in high school. At least in primary school, there's only one teacher, which can be good or bad, but it's very hard. And look, in my journey, I've done everything from write to ministers, write to my local council member, state and federal ministers, to try and get change, particularly around suspension and exclusion, because it's just so counterproductive and it doesn't produce behavior change at all. And we know that. They know that. There's so much research about this. Suspension and exclusion only makes behavior worse. It does not improve behavior. It just doesn't. It doesn't set an example. It doesn't discourage, because it's the same kids who are being suspended and excluded over and over and over again. So I've done a lot of advocacy around that. But what I would also like to see happen, and what I also ask schools to do, is provide parent education sessions so that parents who may not have children with ADHD or autism can perhaps learn something about ADHD and autism, in order that they are perhaps less judgmental and less inclined to fire off emails to schools demanding that something happen in relation to behaviour that they've heard about by a particular child. And look, I know that happens all the time. In one of my classes, fortunately not my child, but a couple of parents took it on themselves to try and rally a petition to have a child excluded from the school. And I mean, that's just so outrageous. We're still talking about a kid who's got a developing brain who is not doing well, and you just want to kick that problem to the curb and make it someone else's problem. Like, that's, it's not going to produce better people. It's such a poor example for the other kids in the classroom and the other kids in the school to see children who are so obviously in crisis and distress be treated in that fashion. It doesn't change their behavior, and it makes children who are observing all of that grow up to be judgmental and demanding that we create more jails for kids and adults, instead of actually putting money into things like social housing and better mental health support services and better family services and family support services.
What I would love to know is, what are some of the common myths around what are schools required to do, air quoting? Because I feel like there's some myths around there, and then a lot of the parents are trying to figure out what they are allowed to do, what they're not, what their rights are, what they can do, and we actually don't know.
Well, can I tell you, people say, the first thing that comes to mind is all the gatekeeping that goes on. Your child will be better off in the state school system because they have more resources. Now, that's just an absolute fallacy. Private schools get more funding from the government than state schools, and then they get parent fees on top of that. State schools have less resources. There is no question. You go into any state school and you're going to see less resources than any of the private schools or independent schools around. So being told that and making families feel unwelcome at the get-go is gatekeeping. It's unlawful. And then once they realise that your child has ADHD or autism, and then they start to suggest that you should go leave their school and go to a specialised school, or go to a flexi school, or go to, in my experience, flexi schools start out with good intentions, but it's still a form of segregation. And by the time they're in 12 plus, my observation is that there's a lot of babysitting that goes on until they leech out of the system. By about 14 years, lots of kids just start disappearing out of the system and no one chases them up. So my goal is that we have inclusive mainstream schools, and that mainstream schools account for everybody. But there is the International Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities creates a right for inclusive education, right? That's international law, and we subscribe to it. Australia, I mean. There's International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, recognising the right to of everyone to an education, Article 13. Again, we subscribe, Australia subscribes to that. So under international law, they have a right. Then there's the Disability Standards for Education, which is a Commonwealth piece of legislation. Our children have a right to be included in mainstream education. And then there's the Human Rights Act Queensland 2019. Every child has the right to have access to primary and secondary education appropriate to their needs. Now, it's worded quite generally, which is the nature of legislation, but arguably there is your child's right to have their needs met in their local school. It's the law. Like, I don't know how more clearly we can be. It is the law. And it's the law that applies to both state schools, independent schools, religious schools, flexi schools. It applies to every single school. But there is this myth that it only applies to state schools. Well, that's rubbish. The problem is, you can have all the rights under the sun, But until you're prepared to enforce them in a court of law, they mean nothing. And it's very difficult to make the decision to spend the money. Litigation's extremely expensive, to take a school to court and enforce your rights. And it also puts your vulnerable child on the front page of the local paper, the local news. You know, it puts them, and it puts them in the middle of a big fight. Now, those are the two reasons that we have not taken it up with all of the schools that have rejected us. But I have still made complaints to the Human Rights Commission, and the school I made a complaint about had to apologise, and I thought that was at least a step in the right direction. And there was interest in understanding how they could do things better. But it's the law. And so you can always take these things to schools, and it is actually the law. You actually do have to provide an education to my child, and you have to make reasonable adjustments for them. Now, often in my experience, they pull out a list of ticker box things, an extra 5 minutes in exams and two movement breaks a day, or like a generic set of adjustments, which, look, it's a starting point. So that's something you can start with. But it also plays into every kid's the same, and they're just not. What I advocate for is that teachers get to know their kids, and that they, by knowing the kids in their classroom, then you build a relationship with them and you can problem solve things as they arise. When a child tips over into some kind of meltdown or exhibits some really either offensive or confrontational behaviour, it's often not what happened immediately before. It is a build-up of things that have taken every last bit of self-control out of them, and they have just lost their ability to manage their emotions. And so they've tipped into a meltdown. If you know your child, then the chances of that happening are reduced significantly just by knowing them, by understanding what their stresses are, by hearing them, by seeing them. Then you get to know what their tells are, when they're not doing well, when they're starting to become overwhelmed, if something is going to overwhelm them. But kids are dynamic. They change through the course of the year. What upset them at the beginning of the year may not be a problem at the end of the year. So yeah, it's all built on relationship. But kids have a right to be included. And this just seems to be swept under the carpet. And I don't know why. It's state, federal, and international laws and policies that give kids the right to be included in their local school.
I have a friend, and she was at our first public school that we were at, where I had a massive fallout with them. And they do exclusion particularly badly, even though they say they do it well. And I had a friend who was there, and her little boy was autistic, and he would have meltdowns at school, and he could be quite explosive. There was a number of times where she emailed them, it was all on the plans that were very poorly done and poorly communicated to everybody, that he doesn't like to be touched when he's melting down. And what would happen is the teacher on duty would go over and attempt to comfort him, and it's only in a nice way, in a way that is, they didn't mean to, it was not malicious. They would touch him on the shoulder and say, "Are you okay, mate?" And he would turn around and punch them in the face. Then the parents would be called to school, "Your child has punched a teacher in the face again. Now you're on this behavior management plan." And she would go around and feel insane, because she's like, "Why are you touching him? Don't touch him. He is very explosive. He punches, he will kick, he will hurt you. Don't touch him, give him space." And they went around in a circle, and then in the end they were on this behavior plan and they were looking at being expelled because they were inadvertently triggering him off, but nobody could communicate to the other teachers. And is that the kind of thing you've experienced?
100%. That's exactly the experience we've had in more than one place, you know, exactly that, where don't go near him. Like, my son's autistic and ADHD, and eye contact isn't an issue, but when he is becoming dysregulated, eye contact is very energy consuming. So don't try and hold his gaze. He knows that someone needs to have eyes on him, but don't go near him. Just leave him, give him some space, let him walk around, let him regulate himself. And I have, this was always, we've had so many of those plans drive me insane. But an ongoing conversation is better than a written plan. But we would have this in the plan. And Wendy, don't wait till you get to high school where there might be, well, there's numerous teachers and you've got absolutely no chance of getting in front of any of them. There is no way they are reading plans for 20 kids, because now, you know, there is a lot of kids that have these plans and they're just, they don't read all these plans. There's no way they don't. So that they have no way of knowing not to do it. But even the special needs teachers in two schools that we've been in, we had exactly the same experience where I've had many discussions about this. Don't argue with him. Don't waggle your finger at him. Don't raise your voice. Just leave him. Don't touch him. Don't go near him. Just let him cool down. And I, in, on two occasions at each of these schools, I was there with my mouth on the ground because I'm watching the special needs teacher, in one case, waggling her fingers, arguing, telling him, I did not say that. I did. I'm like, what are you doing? Just step back. Just step back. And then in the other case, when he was in primary school, going marching up to him, and I could see he was trying really hard to sort himself out so he could find a safe way to get to me, because I was standing at one end of the corridor and he was at the other, without, he just, he knew he needed to bridge that gap, but he just was, she marched up to him, invading his sort of narrow space already, and telling him, like, don't go near, what are you doing? Like, it's all in the plan. And then he gets into trouble. For his reaction to what they do, he gets into trouble. And at no stage did any of those adults ever say to him, you know what, mate? I didn't manage that well yesterday. I could have done that better. I'm really sorry for my part in what happened. Next time I see that you're getting distressed, I know that blah, blah. No attempt to repair from the teacher, but my son gets suspension, has to apologize. You know, how unfair does that? Oh, it's, you've given the information and it's totally ignored. And you know what? The thing is, I don't care about teachers or anyone making mistakes, because everyone does. As parents, there's plenty of times where it's, you say things, you instantly regret saying them. But you have to own that. You have to own that. You have to own it, because it teaches them to own it. So you own your part in it. And I'll tell you something, meltdowns don't happen in a vacuum. Everybody in that space is contributing to that meltdown. The teacher's reaction to the child, the energy from other kids, the environment. But the person who has the most power in the room is the teacher. So the way they use that power has a massive impact on that child. They have to learn to walk that dog. They have to learn to use their power to minimize the chance of that child becoming dysregulated.
Oh, I agree. And like in all of your advocacy, and I know you've had such a long road with this, what do you think does work or can work a bit better?
In the same way as working with my child, acknowledging what is done well, acknowledging effort, acknowledging that they're doing their best, that acknowledging their experience, acknowledging, think, yeah, there's that, you want to offer your observations that are positive, introduce what might be new information that will hopefully inform how they manage your child going forward, and then finish with a way to check on how that's going and follow up in some way. So written communication is good because you can try and be balanced about that, like acknowledging what's done well, introducing what you think might help them going forward, and then a way in which you can follow up on whether that has been helpful or not, and what might next step be. Like everyone needs to hear that they're doing something well before it, like you, obviously, for, certainly I have reached situations with particular people where we have nothing left to say to each other. I've got principal of the school, that caused my son to try and kill himself. I have nothing good to say to him or about him. He decided to give him a 4-week suspension in the end of week two when he had started at the school 2 weeks before because he was going to cut down on bad behaviour.
Fucking hell, I'm so sorry. That's floored me, hey.
Look, and I think people don't understand the impact that suspension and expulsion has on children. Like, to when people say, oh, he wants it, he just wants to be at home. Look, I challenge that. I think that overwhelmingly kids want to be at school and kids want to be learning and kids want to be in classrooms and be welcoming classrooms. I think kids want to learn. They're just hungry for information and knowledge, curious about the world. Naturally, that's how we're born. To keep the emotional toll it takes on kids to suspend them and to keep punishing them in that way is enormous. It is soul destroying. And I think that it's something that people like to tell themselves to make themselves feel better about the fact that kids are the same kids are so often expelled and suspended that, oh, they don't want to be here anyway. I actually don't think that's true. I think kids do want to be in school. They may not be scholars, but kids like to learn and kids like to be with their peers and make friends and be social and be part of what's going on, what everyone else is doing. And then people come down on young adults and adults who don't work and call them welfare bludgers and just get a job. If you've never had an opportunity to get an education, it becomes very difficult to get a job. If you've never been nurtured in a school environment, it becomes very difficult to find a work environment because in many ways there's a lot of shared things. You've got to learn to be part of a group. You've got to learn to manage conflict in a group situation. You've got to manage social situations. And if you're excluded from all of that, it's very difficult to find a workplace that will have you, that will give you a go. Yeah, like it's very unfair. We push these kids out of school because they're not sitting up with whole body listening and doing what we expect of them, even though by definition, by diagnostic definition, their brains are not at that stage yet. And then they fall out of the school system without an education, and then we continue to humiliate and punish them for relying on welfare to get through life.
What are some tips? If someone listening to the podcast has a child that is not sitting up with whole body listening, perhaps has some meltdowns at school, they are quite explosive in their reactions. Should we start documenting early? Because you don't want to feel like you're prepping for like a huge war or a huge argument, but you may start to feel like, I think we're going into a vortex of a behaviour management plan, which I feel like is a performance management out.
Look, I'm a prolific emailer, so there's always a paper trail, and that can be good and bad. My advice is to sit on emails for at least 24 hours, particularly if it's in response to something that's really upset you. I always confirm things in writing because I like to have a record of what was said and done when we have meetings. I was in the practice of following up with an email. I continue to sit in on meetings and have long stopped doing that because in the end, it's just this fluid, ongoing relationship with the school and there's almost no point in saying, you said in term one that we would do this or that. I just continue to advocate to progress his education and to keep a dialogue ongoing. I think that's the position that most parents find themselves in because if you were to take, I have certainly written to ministers over things and I've had some good outcomes from that to get him into a special school where they used trauma-informed teaching practices. I needed to go to ridiculous lengths to get him in that school. And we did get him there. But my advice is that emails are good because you can go back and see what was said and perhaps they can reflect on what was said. But nothing is going to be more important than having a continuing dialogue. And you need to find someone in the school, particularly when you get to high school, and you are not going to have any access to their teachers, just none. They won't give you access to them outside of the 6-minute teacher interviews that you get once or twice a year. And they are 6 minutes long, and then you have to move on. So they won't give you access. So you need to find someone in the school who is going to advocate for your kid, or at least keep an eye on how things are going. And that's tricky sometimes to find that person. It might be in the special needs area. It might be in the leadership area. But you having someone who is at the school is critical to continuing the dialogue that's needed to keep them progressing their education, and not just allow time to pass and him to sit in the library reading a book while the years go by.
So what about if it still happens all the time when a child is punished by being kept in at lunchtime or kept in at recess? And even schools that are quite good, and good air quoting, like they're a bit more understanding, they've got a better inclusion system, I still see and hear that happening. What can we do if we have a child that is being kept in for lunchtime because of something that they've done?
Well, that's also unlawful. So I've got some great articles on informal and formal segregation, which is what that is, when they're like to keep an ADHD kid in the classroom at lunchtime, which is their opportunity to get out and run and be free, is so counterproductive. The counter argument to that is, well, in the playground, which is so unstructured and so unruly, they can also come undone in the playground. And that's true. So they need support in the playground in the sense of at least having someone around who's aware of what's going on. There is rules around segregation. It's also not allowed. Like schools do it for lots of reasons, but gee, it's hard not to say just because it's easier to keep that kid away from everyone else. It doesn't teach the child anything. And you know what it teaches all those other kids? That the way we deal with people who are not doing well or who are vulnerable is we lock them up, we exclude them.
It does. And then they also miss valuable time to make a friend or to maintain a friendship because they haven't been there at lunchtime when they've got to play. Like that's the only part of school that they probably enjoy. Yeah. So one of my kids was being punched multiple times every day by another child. And the response I got from the school was that, don't worry, that child is going to be now separated and be kept in every lunchtime and recess for 2 weeks. And I was like, did you do that for me and my child to make me feel good? Because that does not make me feel good. And I ended up advocating for the other child that I didn't even know, because I was like, that's actually not going to fix it though. Yeah. Like, that's not a good solution. And there's a real lack of understanding from the teachers and the inclusion team about why I didn't think that was a very good idea when they thought that I was going to be happy with that. They'd actually done that for me.
Yeah. Appeasing other parents is a massive motivation for so many outcomes in schools. Certainly that I've had leadership in schools tell me that the reason that they're doing certain things is because otherwise these other parents will blow up. Oh,
I couldn't understand it, because my suggestion ended up with, why don't we keep a diary of when this punching is happening? It seems to be happening because I diaried it at this particular part of the bamboo in this particular area of the yard. How about you, the teachers, like whoever was going to have him in the classroom, this child, and separate him and make him eat lunch in this classroom with you, whoever that person is, get them to go out to the bamboo and stand there and see what the issue is. And be a detective and figure out what is creating this issue with this other child ending up getting so angry and frustrated that he's getting punched.
Yeah.
Let's just go and do that. And then lo and behold, yes, my child was continuing to talk to the child about what he should and shouldn't be doing and was bossing him around, which I could totally see happening. And the other child was getting so frustrated, he lacked skills and he just punched him a number of times. Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, let's just sit these two kids down, see what the problem is, and sort it out, because otherwise there's no skill building taking place.
100%.
But it was like hitting my head against a brick wall, trying to get them to understand that would be a better use of resources than just taking the other kid out and putting him in detention.
That being curious about behaviour is number one response to any situation in a school grant. Like, if something is happening, be curious. What is going on that is producing that unwanted outcome? If we just punish the unwanted outcome, we're never going to understand. And being genuinely curious about what's going on. We were in a school where I sat in the office day after day after day after day because at that point I felt I needed to be on school grounds to support my son in case anything happened because I was so worried about them punishing him unnecessarily. And I sat in the office and it was just a constant stream of kids providing statements about incidents. So it was just this, criminalizing of behavior where everyone was just constantly pulling in statements. So they gather all these statements from all the kids who are around about the incident. And then they get out their chart of punishments. And they go, right, swearing, yep, hitting, yes, through this, right. So that adds up to, okay, you're suspended now for 8 days. That is not being curious about what happened. Being curious about what happened is talking to the kids involved and trying to understand what is going on.
Like, this is the thing that gets me is I get that there's a lack of resources and that teachers are overwhelmed. I completely understand that. I would not want to be a teacher. I get it. However, there is resources and time being spent on discipline.
Yep.
I'm just asking, why can that not be used in a more of a proactive way?
Yep.
And it's not the teacher's fault because they're doing what they're told. That's the way that they've always done it. That's their professional development. They can't really go against the grain. I get that, each individual person. But parenting has come a long way.
Yeah.
And so we are parenting and learning and trying our bloody best, right? You're sitting in the office every single day. I've got a friend who sat in a car park to wave to her child in the lunchtime for 3 months. She sat in the car to wave at her child to get her kid there.
Yep.
So but the schools are very behind in the way that they use their resources and the limited resources they have.
Oh, look, it was one person in leadership. It was their primary task was to gather all these witness statements and prepare a report on how many suspension days or whatever. It's a whole person's job. It was crazy.
Okay. This leads me to one of my last questions. If you feel like, let's say, for example, we've been in how many three schools? We've only been to three. This is our third one. So I know that you've been to more than I have been. So we've had the experience of being stonewalled at the other two schools that I've been at. And I've ended up going, can I beat my head against this brick wall that's not going to ever move in a system that is a concrete brick wall that I do not agree with? No, I cannot. And I've moved on. Yep. So if you feel like a school is stonewalling, but you do want to stay there, you have to stay there, you, whatever it is, your child has friends there, whatever it is, what is the next escalation step? Like, what can we do if we're getting nowhere?
You can certainly write to ministers and complain and write to, certainly once you're in the state school system, I've written to ministers, local members, and asked them to make representations to the school and brought our situation to their attention. I have written to the Department of Education. I appealed that 4-week suspension that led to my son trying to kill himself. I got a decision 6 months later. Like, he'd served his time and they just confirmed the decision. So I would love to know the statistics on how many appeals are actually heard within the period of the sentence and how many are successful. And I bet that the appeals take longer than the sentence imposed and to be decided. And my experience with trying to interact with the Department of Education is terrible.
Oh, by then it's well past. And this is the part that I think in advocacy I'm really struggling at the moment with across the board, like with the ADHD medication issue, with the education system. There's so many areas that I'm like, how are we in a medication shortage again, right? If you actually look at it, you're like, how can this just be left where nobody is listening? And then it feels like with the education system, there's almost no point complaining.
No, I don't say there's no point because even though it feels pointless, the more people that write and complain about these things, then the more pressure there is to change. And because I did the same thing with Catholic education and wrote and complained up and up to churches, to the Catholic education head office, to wrote to my local priest and all sorts of things. And everyone just pats you on the head and says, really sorry to hear that. But the more people that write and complain about the way their children are dealt with by these schools, the more pressure there is to bear on leadership to bring about change. I know from discussions with people who are senior in both the Department of Education and CatEd that there is an understanding at that level that suspension and expulsion doesn't work. Of course there is, because there is no evidence that it works to change behaviours. And there's so much evidence to show the importance of properly resourcing programs in schools, inclusive education strategies that sort of like trauma-informed education strategies and relationship-based strategies, and to try and get change at the school level is really difficult. And I was in a conversation with someone who was telling me that they had were at a conference. The conference was about not using suspension or expulsion in schools. That was no longer going to be something that schools were going to be doing. It had to be an absolute last resort. And that was the conference. That's what it was about. It was for principals. And one of the principals came up to her and said, oh, can you tell me, I really want to get rid of this kid. She's like, were you sitting in on the conference all day today? Like, you own the kids in your school and you need to work it out with them. So that is what we need you to do. Not push them down, not kick that problem down the road and make it someone else's. You keep the kids in your school, and you work out what you need to.
But is that about just othering people? Because it's like, oh, okay, cool, I get it. I'm going to apply this for all of these kids, but there's just this one or two that I just really don't like, and I just want to get rid of them, and then I'll work really hard on the other ones.
Oh, it was flabbergasting that to be at a conference where that is the message, and then you're still saying, but there's just this one kid I've got to get rid of. No, mate, no. Yeah.
That seems like something that that child's doing to trigger that principal, where she just like hardcore emotionally wants to get rid of him. But that's her issue.
I think that illustrates, though, the problem with bringing about this change. We all have to invest in it. So we all have to keep writing our letters. We all have to keep escalating things to teacher, then principal, then department head if it's in Department of Education, then ministers, then if it's in CatEd, going up to Catholic Education Head Office. We have got to keep writing our letters. We have got to keep saying, this is my situation and it's not fair. So we need to do better here. This is the impact it's having on me and my family. This is the impact it's having on my child. You are in breach of the law. We can keep reminding them about the law, UN level, national level, state level. The law is that you have to include my child, and you are failing to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say what we might do is we might put in, if you don't mind emailing me afterwards, we'll put in the show notes the legislation that you're referring to. As you said, I think you've made a great point. We have to keep the pressure on. But maybe your expectation by sending the letters is that I am only increasing the pressure. I'm not expecting that this may go anywhere for my specific child today. But writing the letters anyway. But I think expecting the response and feeling let down.
Oh, it's infuriating. Yeah, it is infuriating too. The amount of letters that I have written. And, you know, what I would recommend is going to the Human Rights Commission. You make your complaint to the Human Rights Commission. They will look at it. It's a voluntary jurisdiction, though, so the school has to agree to go along. But it continues that dialogue and it continues that pressure to change, and it's an opportunity for it to be on the record somewhere that they have broken the law, that they have discriminated against your child based on their disabilities and that they haven't given them a fair opportunity. I did that. That was one thing I did where I thought, oh, it's not going to go anywhere. But at least I got to have a couple of really good discussions with CatEd and felt that at least someone heard me who was in a position where it might just change the dial even just a fraction.
Oh, I agree. But some of the action that they can take in mediation is that they educate the other party.
Yeah, that's right.
And for me, I've had a couple of complaints that I put into the Human Rights Commission. And the only ask that I've had is, could you please provide this person with education around disabilities? And that's all I've wanted.
And look, that's right. I wanted them to have all their staff attend an education session about ADHD and autism and the law that requires that they are included in mainstream schools.
That's a major win.
Yeah, I felt good about it because I just thought it was one of those situations where I wanted to explore enrolling my son there and they were just flat out like, no, we don't have kids like that. I was like, what? Yeah, no, we don't do that. And I just thought there is no easier adjustment to make than to not have him here for half the day. But I just could not believe the complete, unashamed, confident discrimination outright.
I feel like the person who delivered it was probably neurodiverse themselves because like neurotypical people no. would wrap that up into a gift wrapping and then deliver it in a different way. That person has just gone, yeah, no, not having kids like that. We include everybody, but just not ones that are no. like that. Okay, Tanya, we are going to wrap up. That was an awesome episode. Thank you so much. If you loved the episode, you can check out Tanya's other episodes on school holidays, meltdowns, and also she's got one on schools. I will put those in the show notes. I will also get from Tanya the legislation in the show notes so you can actually look that up. You can quote it. The schools may really regret Tanya ever doing this episode where everyone is now armed with legislation about inclusivity. And also I'll put in a link to the Human Rights Commission. Thank you so much for your time. If you've loved this episode, we are going to do another episode in the mini series with Tanya, and it's going to be about co-regulation in the classroom. So check that one out when it comes out. Thank you so much for your time, Tanya.
No problems. Thanks, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.